All rise. The Illinois Appellate Court's Second Division is now in session. The Honorable Justice Rena Van Tine is presiding.
Thank you. Hello, good morning, everyone. Please be seated. So we will be hearing the case of Jasmine Etheridge versus Timothy Jamison. Counsels, would you please approach the bench? Good morning. Would you please tell us your names, spell them, and say who you're representing.
Certainly. Myra Futris. My last name is F-O-U-T-R-I-S for the appellant.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Matthew Arnoux, A-R-N-O-U-X, and I represent the appellate.
Good morning, counsels. Go ahead and have a seat, Mr. Arnoux. So each side is given 15 minutes to present your arguments. Ms. Futris, you can begin. Do you have any rebuttal time that you want reserved?
I usually don't use all my time, but I suppose I'll keep 5 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you, Justice Van Tine. Good morning.
Good morning
to counsel for the appellee. When Timothy filed his petition for review of child support in October 2015, Cook County had neither subject matter jurisdiction nor personal jurisdiction over the appellant. The question then is whether she consented to the court's exercise of subject matter or personal jurisdiction and what constitutes that consent. With respect to subject matter jurisdiction, the statute here, the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, in Section 205A2, provides that even if everyone has left the state, the circuit court retains jurisdiction to modify its previously entered order if the parties, quote, consent in the record or in a record or in open court. So what does that mean?
Yeah, what does it mean? Because aren't there a number of our Illinois Supreme Court cases that state that judges get subject matter jurisdiction from the Constitution, and the Constitution gives judges jurisdiction over any general subject matter that they can hear. So in this case, it's a domestic relations case, but you're suggesting that the judge did not have subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, the statute clearly provides that when both parties and the subject child have left the state, there's one small exception for if one of the parties is out of the state and the other party is in another country, but that's not relevant here. If both parties have left the state and the child is not here, the court only retains jurisdiction to modify if the parties consent. And what the committee comments show us is this is really meant for the parties' convenience. You know,
the committee, the statute, you're saying, prevails over the Illinois Constitution.
Well, I mean, I'm not aware that this statute's ever been challenged. I guess I haven't thought about that,
yeah.
Justice
no,
McBride.
Well, so are you saying that?
Yes, the
that
statute.
All the cases that suggest that courts have subject matter jurisdiction, if it's the type of case that they are generally permitted to hear, mm-hmm. which is a domestic relations matter.
But this was a parentage case that had been off call for years at this point. You know, I think it's
how many years? There was
three.
Quite a bit of, oh, okay.
So right. it's
and
actually,
then,
this brings up an interesting point, which is that in 2012 was the party's first modification. So at that time, Timothy filed a petition to modify. Everyone was out of the state. He didn't properly serve it on Jasmine again, but he did mail it to her. And she did consent to both the court subject matter jurisdiction to modify and its personal jurisdiction over her by appearing in the matter, filing her own petition for rule, etc. And eventually that issue was resolved by entry of an agreed order and the case went off call again. So,
oh, so there was a time when the court didn't have jurisdiction, but because the parties consented when there was a request for modification.
Right. He consented by filing it. She consented by appearing and litigating the matter. And I'm sure that's what he hoped she would do this time as well. Neither of them were here.
Did you say that then there was no appearing or litigating anything that December 15, 2015 day?
That's correct.
Okay. And tell me why we shouldn't just get rid of this case because you haven't given us anything for the record of those proceedings. There's no report of proceedings. There's no bystander's report. And there's no agreed statement of facts as to what actually occurred when that order was entered.
When the December 2015 order was entered?
Yes. You're challenging that, aren't you, along with the 2017 order? Or you're not?
No, the 2015 order was just entered following a status appearance. That's the order that said this attorney Clark showed up for Jasmine.
Showed up?
Attended court and said he was there on behalf of
Jasmine. Is that what the order reads? Showed up, attended, or does it say appeared?
Let's see.
Either way, I think we need to know.
I know, but
I think we need to know if you're challenging, I thought you were challenging the 2015 order and the 2017 orders.
Well, there is no order in 2015, the court modified support.
Right.
Without subject matter and personal jurisdiction.
Well, what did that order say that day? Do you have it in front of you? It was Judge Kaplan, wasn't it?
Yes.
Didn't he say he had jurisdiction? Didn't he say the attorney appeared? Didn't he enter substantive orders, actually, because he temporarily modified support? And then what else did he do?
I think we're talking about two different orders. On October 23rd, 2015, oh, no, I'm sorry, that's not correct. That's not. It was in March, it was on March 16th of, I'm sorry, December 9th, 2015. Judge Kaplan entered an order providing that Clark appeared on behalf of Jasmine and sought a continuance.
What else does it say? Oh, you don't have the order.
The court. I'm sorry?
What else does the order say?
The court gave Clark leave to file his appearance, gave her an additional 28 days to respond to her petition, required the discovery issue within 45 days, and set hearing on Timothy's petition to modify for March 16th, 2016.
So is it 2016 when he entered substantive orders that I'm... I thought Judge Kaplan entered
Judge
such
Kaplan
orders
in,
where
in,
he temporarily modified.
Yes, in 2015, he had, on that same day, December 9th, 2015, he reduced Timothy's support obligation from $3,500 a month to $1,000 a month, payable via the SDU, and temporarily suspended his obligation to make $1,000 monthly payments into the 503G trust for college.
He also said that he had jurisdiction over the parties. Was that in that order?
No, that's not in the order.
Okay. Are you looking at the order?
No, I'm looking at my summary of it.
Oh, okay.
Order said he had jurisdiction, I would have included that in my statement of facts because that would absolutely be relevant, Justice McBride.
Okay. Well, maybe I'm wrong. I think there's...
jurisdiction of the parties and...
But you don't have the order in front of you, so that's all right. You don't have it.
So I don't.
All right. So are you challenging that order or not?
I probably do in this pile of papers.
No, I'm not asking if you have it. I'm asking you, are you challenging...
No, I'm not challenging that order entered after status. Our position is that the court at no time from 2015 through 2017, when the final modification order was entered and the matter again went off call, had subject matter jurisdiction over the modification or personal jurisdiction over Jasmine.
Okay, so I just want to make, I'm just trying to get this
clear.
Are you telling us today that you're not challenging the 2015 order where the judge entered substantive orders and the attorney appeared in front of Judge Kaplan?
Specifically the December 9th, 2015.
That is an
three
order.
Orders that
sure.
Were entered.
That is an order in the procedural progression to the final 2017 order.
So
which
you are challenging it.
Sure. I mean, it's
well,
it was an order.
We have to know what you're arguing on appeal. So I guess we're going back now to my original question. Why should we not, under Fouch versus Bryant, simply dismiss this issue because you have not given us a report of proceedings as the appellant? You have not provided any agreed statement of facts, and you have not provided a bystander's report of what actually happened that day under Supreme Court rules.
That was a status appearance that was a decade ago, so there is no record of it available, save what the court summarized at length and report it in its order. I think that provides the court with a sufficient record of what occurred on that date at that status appearance.
But it was beyond a status appearance because at least one of those orders had a substantive ruling reflecting the reduction of Timothy's child support obligation, right?
It was.
It went down to $1,000 a month.
Yeah, it was a status, Justice Van Tine, and things like this do happen at statuses in Cook County. But that was a status appearance, and maybe perhaps Judge Kaplan, God bless him, said, you know, we have a lawyer for her. I'm gonna take some action. I don't know. I can only.
So then I guess it goes back to my question. I'm gonna have to ask you one more time. You've said that you're appealing every order that was in progression to the 2017.
Yes, they're void.
And on the 2015 order, the judge actually entered substantive rulings. He actually temporarily modified the support, and he also said that the $1,000 payment to the trust fund didn't have to be made. So my question is, are you saying that for purposes of Fouch that you don't have to provide what Supreme Court Rule 328 requires because it was a status hearing or something else?
There is no other record of that court appearance save what the court reported in its own order.
Right, but that's not what the rule requires. If you don't provide us with anything, then what do we have to look at?
I think you have a sufficient record for what occurred that date in the order itself.
Okay.
In addition, remember we're in the motion for summary judgment context. All well-pled allegations are to be construed in favor of Jasmine. I mean, this, you know.
It is summary judgment, so there's no dispute as to the facts. Is that correct?
Well, the court found there's no genuine issue of material facts.
So therefore, what benefit would the transcript do if we know, you know, Fouch says we disqualify a case when we don't have a record. That's only if
absence
of the record
right.
impedes our decision.
Mm-hmm.
Here we know what the summary judgment was. The summary judgment was by standing up in front of the court. Jasmine consented. So that's what the issue is. So let's go forward.
And it's on the pleadings alone.
Right.
I mean, a summary judgment under 1401 is done on the pleadings, taking all well-put allegations in favor of my client. So do you have any other questions in that vein, Justice McBride?
Well, I'm not sure what your summary judgment request is. Do you think there's questions of fact as to whether the court... I think the issue here is whether the court had jurisdiction at any time. Except in 2015, 2017. So, and if the order reflects that the court said it had jurisdiction, what do we do with that?
Jasmine has never had in 2015 to 2017 an appearance on file. She never filed a responsive pleading. She never filed, like she did in 2012, a motion of her own, a petition for contempt because he wasn't paying support. She never submitted herself, this non-resident respondent, to the jurisdiction of the court during that period of time. That's personal jurisdiction. As far as subject matter, you know, the statute tells us what you have to do to submit yourself to the subject matter jurisdiction of the court over modification proceedings.
Subject matter jurisdiction is the ability, inherent ability of court to hear this mm-hmm. particular kind of case.
Yes.
And 205 actually is talking about domestic relation cases, so subject matter jurisdiction is really not an issue. When we talk about, the cases say, when we talk about jurisdiction, aren't we talking about jurisdiction? We have an out-of-state party, all the parties out of state. Aren't we talking about consent for the court to exercise jurisdiction over non-resident citizens? We're not talking about subject matter. We're talking about general jurisdiction. You misnamed it and called it subject matter, but aren't we talking about general jurisdiction? The right of Illinois courts to hear cases of people who live in Georgia, in Texas, they don't have any connection with Illinois. Are we talking about general jurisdiction? The Supreme Court, in the case of Zabel versus both parties cited this case, they're talking about the jurisdiction of Illinois to exercise, the right of Illinois to exercise jurisdiction. We're not talking about subject matter because, of course, the court can hear domestic relations cases. Are we talking about general jurisdiction, the right of Illinois to exercise power over non-residents?
Well, I mean, the statute says the court can only modify its previously entered judgment if the parties consent. That once the parties are gone, the court loses jurisdiction. But if the parties consent under the statute, then it can hear it.
Well, we're not talking, that's my point. We're not really talking about subject matter. We're talking about
general jurisdiction.
General jurisdiction.
Okay.
Well, okay, let's talk about consent. You weren't able to find any cases from anywhere else. Did you suggest that consent should be in writing in your brief?
I mean, all I said is that's what California decided. I mean, every state has adopted the UIFSA, but nobody has defined this phrase except for California that said it should be written and filed. But I mean, there's only 10 cases citing 205 in general. And
yeah,
nothing
and it varies from state to state, right? Notwithstanding that uniform appears in the caption of that law, there are various iterations of it.
It certainly can, although Californians and Illinois are the same, but it certainly does vary in different states. You know, the court, Second District, kind of teetered toward it in this Collins case, but declined to consider the issue because it found that the obligor father in that case didn't provide authority to it, although I don't know what he would have provided because there isn't any besides the statute.
Wouldn't we be misconstruing the statute, though, if we took your position that it should be in writing?
When
the legislature said.
Certainly.
A record in court or
open court.
Or open court, sure.
Or consent. It didn't say anything about in writing. And wasn't there a previous version of the Illinois statute that did have the written, or am I mistaken?
No, you're not mistaken. The same statute provides with respect to another issue that written consent is required. That's not an open court issue, and I can't recall what it is. I think it's one party remains in Illinois, but both parties file a written consent, quote unquote, in another state for that state to hear the modification proceedings. Something like that is earlier in the statute. So your written consent is referenced elsewhere. I actually didn't argue in my briefing that the consent should be in writing. I simply reported to the court the only decision on this issue out of California. I don't know what consent should be. I mean, that's for you to decide if you consider the issue.
Well, don't we have to consider the issue because that's the statute that you're relying on?
Yes.
Don't we have to determine what consent means?
Yes. And
what is your interpretation of what consent means?
I'll tell you what it isn't. It isn't an attorney who you never hired walking into court for a status and saying, hey, I'm here for her, and then disappearing, never to be seen or heard from again. I think it's not that.
What case would you suggest talks about that? I mean, she had very different statements, never by affidavit, that he did appear for her, her mother got him to go to court. There were multiple statements over time, none of which were ever supported by an affidavit. So I don't know, I mean, didn't she eventually come around to saying that he appeared in court on my behalf?
She admitted, if you actually parse her response to the motion for summary judgment, she admitted that it's clear to me when I read it that she's admitting that he stepped up and said, I'm here for Jasmine. She then went on to explain, I never hired him, I never retained him, he never filed an appearance for me, my mother sent him to court.
Okay, so let's get to the summary judgment. What? I know you weren't the attorney. Okay. But I want you to tell us what the attorney meant when, I don't know who the person was, but they conveyed to the court, we are not contesting jurisdiction.
Jurisdiction can only be waived prospectively, not retroactively.
That's not really my question. But that's what you're saying, that on that date, in that particular hearing, at the summary judgment, the lawyer was saying, we're not contesting jurisdiction today. Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't know what she was thinking.
There's no transcript of that hearing either, is there?
There is not.
Okay.
That was evident. That is not a non-evidentiary legal argument.
As Justice House already pointed out, we're reviewing it de novo.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is that you think that attorney was telling the judge, we're not contesting jurisdiction today and going forward. But those weren't the words
I would not engage in conjecture about what she meant. I have no idea what she meant. All I know is that...
So if we don't have a report of the proceedings, what are we supposed to do? Presume that the judge knew what he was doing?
I don't know why you would need a...
Well, because you don't know what... All you've said is you have no idea what that attorney meant when he said, Judge, we're not contesting jurisdiction. What we're really contesting is due process, and we didn't have a right to a fair hearing. That's how I read his remarks.
Is that statement part of the record? You know, we have to get these things in context. You know what context that statement was made.
The judge reported that statement in his order. He said that Jasmine... Let me get the exact language. The court said in its August 12, 2024 order, the only issue this court is determining, which is another problem, I think, is whether Attorney Clark's appearance in court, admitted by Jasmine in her response to Timothy's summary judgment motion to be at her direction, which I lay out in my brief is not actually true or correct if you look at, if you parse her response, constituted a waiver of the argument that the court did not have jurisdiction to enter all orders from 15 through 17. While Jasmine waived this issue in her response to the motion for summary judgment, wherein she admitted that Clark appeared on her behalf, and further waived that issue in the argument against summary judgment when she affirmatively stated that she agrees the court had jurisdiction. This statement by her then very new counsel at this hearing does not retroactively imbue the court with personal jurisdiction over her 9 years, 9 to 7 years earlier. That's clear that personal jurisdiction can only be waived going forward, and the court found that she waived it based on that statement.
Well, hasn't the Supreme Court said on a number of occasions that personal jurisdiction can be established by one, either service or process, or by a party voluntarily submitting to the court's jurisdiction?
That's exactly right. And what the court found here was that Attorney Clark stepping up at a status and saying he was there for her was her submitting herself to the court's jurisdiction.
These words that you're using, this is a status hearing? I mean, you keep calling it a status.
Well, if you look at the order before that, it was set for...
It was set for rulings on specific motions, and the court actually entered orders. I mean, I don't think we can call this a status hearing when the judge modified the order that day. And he also said that you don't have to put $1,000 a month into the trust. I don't know why you keep calling it a status hearing, and I don't think the judge ever called it a status hearing at the summary judgment hearing.
I mean, you'll certainly correct me if I'm wrong, but if you look at the order before that one, I think it was continued for status to that date, but I don't
know. Well, I think it was continued because which date did the lawyer appear on? Let's get that clear. It was a long time ago.
December 9th, 2015.
And that's the only date Christopher Clark appeared, right?
That's right.
And that's the date you keep saying is a status hearing, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And we're not sure yet, but we think the order says that the court said it had jurisdiction of the parties. I don't have the order in front of me right now. Either way.
The order before that one was November 25th, 2015, and I believe it continued the case for status to the 9th. But like I said, I don't have the order in front of me, so I won't make that statement with any certainty.
I think your position is that submitting to the jurisdiction isn't trumped by Rule 103. What is the number? You know, where if you contest jurisdiction, you don't have to do it immediately. It can be contested anytime if you've never done anything to really subject yourself.
Right. You waive jurisdiction by filing a general appearance, you know, and addressing the substance of the case without first objecting to jurisdiction, or by filing your own substantive motion in the case that doesn't contest jurisdiction. And that's what happened in 2012. He mailed her this filing that he did, and she filed a petition for rule against him for nonpayment of support. So obviously she submitted herself to the jurisdiction of the court, despite the fact that she didn't have to. But that's not what happened, and that's probably what he thought was happening in 2015, but it isn't. She didn't appear. She didn't file her own motion.
Well, so that's one of the questions of fact. You know, when an attorney steps up before a judge and says that he is here on behalf of so-and-so. What is the judge supposed to do with that?
Those circumstances are not...
We don't really know exactly what Clark said to him.
We know he didn't file an appearance.
Right, but we don't know what he said that day because we don't have anything other than the order that's in this record.
Without the filing of an appearance, I don't think he could have said anything that would have been... that could have subjected her to the personal jurisdiction of the court on that date.
And what case do you cite that says that a lawyer has to file an appearance in stanter in order to represent a client?
One only waives jurisdiction by the filing of an appearance and the addressing of substantive issues or by filing their own petition in court. So that didn't happen here.
Give me the case. You keep saying this, but give me the case.
That's like the statute
says...
Okay, well, McNally v. Morrison, personal jurisdiction over a non-resident respondent requires proper service, didn't happen, long-arm jurisdiction, didn't exist here, and due process or minimum contacts weren't present here.
Is that, that's in your brief?
I'm sorry?
That's in your brief.
It is.
Yeah.
Municipal Trust and Savings Bank v. Moriarty. Under Illinois law, one waives a jurisdictional objection only by filing a responsive pleading or motion, and that's in Statute 301, or by filing an appearance and making substantive arguments without first objecting to jurisdiction. None of that happened here. So again, the question is, did she submit herself to the to the jurisdiction of the court in terms of her personal jurisdiction, and did she consent to the subject matter jurisdiction of the court, which I take your point, Justice House, that I'm maybe characterizing it differently, but those are the two questions here.
Are you aware of any case since the statute has been modified as it pertains to waiver of personal jurisdiction where an order of the court, where a party submitted to jurisdiction without filing an appearance and making a responsive pleading?
I'm not. I mean, to me, that is a well-established statute and case law with respect to personal jurisdiction. There's none of that took place here.
And what is your client actually seeking in terms of money or whatever? Because there was like years where she was receiving money quite a different amount than what was actually previously ordered. And so for like 7 years, I think the record shows that she was getting, I don't know, $200-$300 a month for the child. There was no money put into the trust. What is she actually asking for?
She filed a petition to vacate the 2017 order, the final modification order, and all of the orders and procedural progression to it, because they're void. That's what the record tells us she wants. I can't tell you from the record what went on in those, and what happened from 2017 to 2024. I mean, I can say for my time.
So I guess I'm thinking now. So when was the summary judgment hearing? Because it was at that
August 24.
Of what?
2024.
Yeah. So at least she was looking, she wanted to go back because the child reached majority in 2023. That was when the support payments were ending.
She filed shortly before the child reached the age of majority. You know, I think for my time doing trial work in these cases, sometimes when people aren't getting paid what they're supposed to be getting paid and there's an arrearage and there's missed payments, sometimes clients lose the thread about what they're ordered and or what they're entitled to, and sometimes they just give up on it. But then a life event happens, like this child heading to college, and you think, I'm owed some money here. I really should try to do something about it. And then she looked at the case on the docket, is what she said in her response to the summary judgment, I'm not, maybe also the 1401, and realized that this order had been entered in 17 after she talked to Timothy, and he said, I didn't have to pay that money into the 503G for many years. So that's how she ended up back
there. Timothy did raise the defenses of estoppel and of latches, but the court didn't address those issues. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, when
They can't really trump jurisdiction, can they? You can't have, you can't be relieved from the jurisdiction by arguing estoppel or laches, can you?
No, and you can't.
We did, one time.
Oh, yes. Well, you remind me.
Yeah, I don't know about
my case. It was a minor state.
But you
what about revestment?
I'm sorry?
What about the doctrine of revestment? We're looking at things that were raised below, but we didn't see any of them here.
I can't address that. I'll be honest with you. I don't even know what the doctrine of revestment is.
Oh, it means that the parties have pretty much given the court back jurisdiction that it had originally. I just wondered, I haven't seen any single case that has applied revestment to this particular UFSA statute.
I mean, I don't know what she would have done to indicate, you know, a desire to revest the court. And again, the statute's really clear about how, you know, the ability to modify returns to the circuit court, and those things didn't happen here.
So backing up a little bit, is it your position that both the December 9th, 2015 order and the July 25th, 2017 order are void rather than voidable?
Void. For lack of jurisdiction, that's right. I mean, the 2015 order was a temporary order. She, even if she knew about it at the time, she couldn't
have. She would have to file under 1301 within 30 days or under 1401 within 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So she was out of the box to contest a voidable order, right? So.
But her position is that the orders were void. I mean, the 2017 order and everything that led to it, all the temporary orders that led to it.
Notwithstanding that she asserted that she wasn't contesting jurisdiction when she argued before the judge that heard the case on August 12th, 2024.
I mean, her pleading filed by her more long-term counsel certainly said otherwise. And again, I mean, whatever this counsel said does not retroactively imbue the court with jurisdiction a decade earlier.
But we can't really interpret that now, I don't think, because the lawyer said we're not contesting jurisdiction, Judge.
I don't think it matters.
We're arguing due process. She didn't have notice in a hearing. That's what
was argued in before Judge Yu, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have Judge Yu's description of her statement where, do you want me to read exactly what he said? I don't remember, to be honest with you, exactly what it was.
It's the last page of the record, common law.
He said that she affirmatively stated that she agrees that the court had jurisdiction.
Jurisdiction when?
Well,
paragraph 22, during the summary judgment argument, Jasmine's counsel conceded that they are not contesting jurisdiction, but rather asserting due process arguments about notice Jasmine may or may not have received. Paragraph 27 of the order, Jasmine argued during the hearing of Timothy's motion for summary judgment that the issue was a due process issue, not jurisdictional.
I mean, due process is, sort of ironically, right, one of the arms of personal jurisdiction. You have, you know, personal jurisdiction over a non-resident defendant. Proper service didn't happen. Minimum contacts weren't present. And then, or I'm sorry, due process, minimum contacts. You know, that is part of personal jurisdiction. So
wasn't the argument, well, I didn't hire him, maybe my mom did, but he did appear for me, he represented me, he was there on my behalf, but
he didn't.
That doesn't amount to.
He didn't appear for her, though. He attended court for her on one occasion. He didn't appear for her. She never retained him. This is her.
Well, if he had come to court and said, I'm not appearing, I'm just sort of here as a bystander, the judge wouldn't have said it for him filing his appearance. And there's no record of any objection.
The order gave him leave to file his appearance. That's right.
Without any, and there's no record of him objecting to any one of those three orders that were entered back in December of 2015, right?
That's right.
So judges now should just, if a lawyer steps up and says, I'm here on behalf of so-and-so, what the judge, that's nothing?
He should have, especially considering we're dealing with a non-resident respondent, he should have continued it until the appearance was filed.
And how many years is he expected to continue it? Is it permissible to just ignore court orders and then later on, years and years down the line, complain about not consenting if you're represented by counsel and all the options?
But she wasn't represented by counsel, and that,
I mean, that's what you're saying.
That's her well-pled allegation in her response to the motion for summary judgment.
And you're basically testifying as to what that lawyer did. And then you're saying that the judge,
I'm reporting what the order said.
We don't have a record. There's an order entered, and the judge entered orders with an attorney in front of him. And then later, they're saying, Judge, this isn't about jurisdiction. It's about due process because she wasn't heard. So, I mean, these are things that we have to wrestle with. So isn't in a record that seems to be pretty absent, except, you know, that a judge entered substantive orders with a lawyer standing in front of him. And we have, you know, I mean, you keep saying, well, he wasn't representing her. Well, you know, that's just your interpretation, but there's nothing that really says he wasn't because the judge entered orders, multiple orders that day with the lawyer. And didn't the judge say that this complaint that she had was with Clark? Didn't Judge Yu say that, that the court had jurisdiction, her complaint is with the lawyer if he wasn't really representing her, and that her damages or whatever she's seeking, is really something that should be directed at this attorney?
The attorney was bound to know the law on that day, and is that correct in that appearance, the objections to personal jurisdiction are not waived unless a filing is made, is that correct?
That's right.
And since lawyers are bound to know the law, isn't the judge held to the same standard?
Yes.
And this judge's mistake was made, and I read the record, this judge's mistake was made when he made his decision based on a case which was superseded by statute.
That's right. I mean,
it was error. We can't.
That's right. From the
what about Judge Kaplan? Are we gonna say from this record here too that he had absolutely no idea what he was doing when he entered those orders?
He basically,
lawyer?
I certainly would never say that Judge Kaplan didn't know what he was doing.
That's one of the orders that's at issue, the 2015.
There's no indication in the record that I saw that Timothy ever told the
exactly.
court that the lady resided out of state in Georgia. He may not have been aware of that.
That it was never disclosed. The initial filing didn't plead that neither party resided in Illinois. I mean, from the very beginning, you could tell that the circuit court didn't understand that she was out of state. Oh, it got mailed to her. If she doesn't show up, she's subject to default.
Oh, you're what? Saying the judge didn't understand she was out of state?
No, absolutely not. It was not... That was not disclosed.
Why was the lawyer told to, on a number of occasions, mail the notice?
Because when people don't show up, by then they may have knew. They certainly didn't know at the beginning. And when people don't show up, trial lawyers are directed to mail the order to the other side, especially if they're not represented by counsel. Send this to them. See if they'll come.
Do you see any significance to the fact that Timothy has paid Jasmine and she accepted like all these child support payments required by these orders in 2015, you know, December 15, as well as July 25th, 2017?
Mm-hmm. We don't know what he's paid. We know what he was ordered to pay. We don't know what he actually paid.
She could have, that's one thing the judge certainly had jurisdiction over, to enforce
absolutely.
Support orders.
Yes, absolutely.
So if he wasn't making payments he was supposed to make, Jasmine could have come into court without any problem.
Yeah, she could have.
Living wherever she was living, mm-hmm. and asked for these overdue payments.
That's right. Or she could have enrolled the judgment in her statement.
It went from $3,500 to $1,000 down to $265.
But these parties don't always do that. Like I said, sometimes over a long period of time, they lose the thread about what they're owed. I think I'm about three times over my time. If anyone has anything else, I'm happy to address it.
Can conduct ever be considered as consent to jurisdiction or implied consent?
To the personal jurisdiction of the court? That is not contemplated in the law as it stands here, as of now. I mean, I can't imagine. The court found that by operation of, I mean, explicitly found in its order, that because Attorney Clark stepped up on one occasion, Jasmine was subject to the jurisdiction of the court. We have all the, we have statutes and case law providing what exactly you have to do to waive a jurisdictional objection. That is not one of them. This would represent a pretty significant expansion of the law surrounding personal jurisdiction, in my opinion.
But in this case, he didn't just step up and ask for a continuance, right?
He was present when other things occurred. That's correct.
So how do we know that?
Because the order reports it. The
okay.
order reports
so he was
what
there.
The order
was,
reports that he was present.
He was there when the substantive orders were entered.
Of course.
But he wasn't representing her.
That's correct. He never filed an appearance on her behalf, and her well-pled allegation said he didn't.
Okay, so everything is hanging on that he was there, he was present, the judge entered substantive orders, the judge said he had jurisdiction over the parties, but you're saying he wasn't, there was no jurisdiction.
There's no statement.
Because the lawyer didn't file an appearance that moment.
Or thereafter. There's no statement in the order that the court found it had jurisdiction over the parties.
There's no what?
I don't think the order said that he found.
Well, the writing's really hard to read.
Well, I'm sorry. The order did say it had jurisdiction of the parties in the preamble.
December 9th, 2015.
Yes.
Okay,
in the
I'm sorry.
Preamble.
I stand corrected. I said I didn't have that one in front of me, so I stand corrected.
Justice House?
No,
anything
else.
Thank you. Counsel, Mr. Arno.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Oral arguments. There have been many, many questions asked of Ms. Fortes, and I appreciate that. So I want to go in a few of those directions, and I think it's very important to look at this case from the beginning. At the very beginning of this case in 2009, nobody lived in the state of Illinois. There was never a time when somebody actually was in Illinois and then left the state of Illinois. And if you look at Section 205A1 and 2 and the committee comments, they speak to whether or not there are two prongs, and it's in the disjunctive. It's that the court has, and I think it is subject matter jurisdiction, if somebody lives here or if they consent. And the initial filing in 2009 when nobody lived here was the consent for subject matter jurisdiction of the Illinois courts. When Mr. Jamieson came back in 2011, there was, again, consent because nobody objected. And so the question of what does a consent mean, if you look at 2011 and 2012, there's no order that says we consent to be because that started basically in 2009. The reason I bring up this point is the question that the court raised with respect to voidable and void orders. If there is no subject matter jurisdiction, it's a void order. And Ms. Etheridge does not have any time bar to attack that order because it's void. And the only way it's void is that there's not subject matter jurisdiction. So initially there was subject matter jurisdiction. They continued that consent through 2011 and 2012 through A2, and they continued again through 2015 through 17.
Without any reflection of open consent or consent in open court or a written consent by anybody since the inception of this case?
Correct. So if we look at the consent in 2009, 2010, 2011, 2012, the consent was not written. It wasn't discussed. It wasn't asked by the court, but it was by their action. And so I would suggest or ask the court to, there are five different ways the court can affirm the appellate court here, and there's maybe one way that the appellate court doesn't affirm, and that would actually send the courts in chaos if you went in that direction. I'll discuss that. But essentially, it's by the action. And so when Christopher Clark walks into a courtroom.
But just a second before we get to that. What about paragraph 2 where it says the court does, once you do have a order that this Illinois court enters, we retain jurisdiction to do everything except when it comes to modification, unless there's consent.
Well,
that's asking for, there's a requirement there for a second consent, because they no longer have jurisdiction according to the statute, unless certain things happen.
I would respectfully suggest that you'd be read in language in the statute that's not there. And what I'd like to point out to you, Your Honor, is that 205A1 indicates at the time of the filing of a request for modification, this state is the residence of the obligor, the obligee, or the child, at the time of the filing. If we go to A2, it doesn't speak to at the time of the filing. All right, so to your
question. It says, or it's related to the time of filing the modification.
Right, it says, so 2 says, even if this state is not the residence of the obligor, the individual obligee, or the child for whose benefit the support order is issued, that's what we have here, the party's consent in a record or in open court that the tribunal of this state may continue to exercise jurisdiction to modify its order.
Correct. So one of the paths the appellate court can take, among the 4 or 5 paths the appellate court can take, is basically to say, look, that consent was made when the filing was initially made, which was not a modification, but was definitely made at the time of the initial modification in 2012. And so there's no requirement in the statute where every time somebody requests to modify, they have to go in again and consent, because the consent
is... Suppose we had parties that all lived in Illinois in 2015, and 2019, everybody moved out of state. How does that statute work for those people and require a different consent, and then require a different consent for modification for the first group of people? How does that work?
Well, that work... The difference is, I would suggest, Your Honor, is that in the first case, this case, the consent was made with the initial filing and the modification. In the example the court is asking about, there was never a consent to modify in any record. And so we look at the case law that we have, and the court cited the Zabel versus Kineski case as an example, although not directly on point, that was actually brought to the Supreme Court under a writ of prohibition, where Judge Kineski, who was the 2nd District DuPage County judge, was entertaining a motion with respect to support under your same scenario, where both parties had lived in the state before the issue at hand, and then they left. The Supreme Court said, and granted, this is why it's not directly on point, it was the previous statute about written consent. The Supreme Court denied the writ of prohibition and sent the case back to Judge Kineski. So it's a different case. But I would suggest what we have to look at the case in a whole. When Attorney Clark steps in the courtroom, and the matter was set for trial, if the court looks at the October 23rd order, the matter was set for trial. And when Christopher Clark walks in at the start of the trial and says, I represent Jasmine Etheridge and I want a continuance, and then stands there as Judge Kaplan enters a temporary order based upon all we have in this record is the order, but we do know that a modification was made, and there's no objection to jurisdiction, nothing from Mr. Clark that says, you can't do that, Judge.
If he objected to the jurisdiction, would he have violated the statute that's directed at personal jurisdiction by objecting, by addressing on the merits the order? Had he objected, he'd be giving up his right to object to personal jurisdiction. No, the statute, he went to court that day. The statute says you don't, as long as you don't file, you don't waive jurisdiction. But had he objected, well, he would have given up that right, wouldn't he?
Right. So we have personal jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction.
Right, I'm talking about personal jurisdiction.
Right. So the fact that he appeared.
Yes.
All right. By her, basically consented to the personal jurisdiction.
Which statute is that?
Well, if we look at 201 of UFSA, which is Article 2 jurisdiction, Section 201.2, an individual submits the jurisdiction of the state by consent, by entering a general appearance. Okay, entering a general appearance. Okay, so the reason
what statute is that you're reading from, sir? I'm sorry.
Okay, it's the Section 201 of the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act is adapted
well,
by.
I'm addressing an Illinois statute.
Right. Know? This is as adapted by Illinois.
Yeah, it's part of the UFSA. We were looking at 205 earlier. 201 is what you're referencing.
Correct. Yeah. And so there's a distinction in the language between entering an appearance and then they go on to say by filing a responsive document. So there's a purpose to the different language. Entering an appearance is coming before a court and apprising the court, the parties in opposition, that I represent so-and-so. That's entering an appearance. He entered the courthouse. He said he appeared. It doesn't say filing. It says filing a responsive document.
It doesn't say filing a written appearance, does it?
No, it does not. It does not. And if we look at 301 of Supreme Court rules, it's interesting when we look at 301A, it says if a written appearance is filed. So it doesn't necessarily contemplate that in all cases a written appearance must be filed. So it gets down to what is an appearance. Right? And my argument, Your Honor, is that when Mr. Clark walked in and essentially entered an appearance under 201, he submitted to the personal jurisdiction of the court. Now, the subject matter jurisdiction was also acquired at that point in time, but more importantly, they waived that argument in the argument before Judge Yu. And all we have is this record here. We can't read into counsel's anecdotal evidence about whether people come back to court. We can only have this record here. If we look at Judge Yu's findings, the findings, as the court pointed out, on 21 was, first of all, that Timothy claims that the court had jurisdiction over Jasmine and subject matter at that point in time. And that during the argument, Jasmine's counsel conceded they are not contesting jurisdiction with due process. That's not prospectively. That was, they were arguing whether or not the court had subject matter jurisdiction in 2015 and 2017. And they waived that argument. That's what the record says. And to find out why
they say due process, right?
We get to the due process.
Right. So there's due process where Illinois courts exercise jurisdiction over residents who don't live in Illinois. Isn't that a due process issue?
Correct. Correct. And that's the personal jurisdiction argument.
That's it goes to both. It goes to subject matter as well. Because Illinois is exercising jurisdiction over the legal rights of people who don't live here. And it's not an enforcement of Illinois' own order. It's a modification which requires the court to reacquire jurisdiction, according to paragraph 2.
Correct. But the due process argument is whether or not Ms. Etheridge, basically on the personal jurisdiction side, that goes to whether it's voidable. And that goes to, yes, if you look at the record.
I'm looking at another statute, the Illinois statute, 735 ILCS 52-301A5, which deals with waiver of personal jurisdiction. And it is a specific statute that goes to, which takes precedent over another statute.
Isn't this one more specific, though? 205?
This goes 201 and 205.
This goes to personal jurisdiction of the court. And it says you don't waive personal jurisdiction unless you file an appearance or response to the lawsuit. And here, this didn't happen in this case.
It happened in 201 and it happened in 205 because when Mr. Clark comes to court and doesn't object to jurisdiction, where the court takes affirmative action, and then
do you have a case that says that?
I don't have a case that says that, Your Honor.
Wouldn't that be a radical change in law? It would change not only 201, but also change the court's interpretation of 2-301 about what is a waiver of personal jurisdiction.
Well, if an attorney appears in court and doesn't object to jurisdiction, never does, and then receives notice and the other party...
Well, that's what the legislature said. It said clearly and unambiguously that you give up your right to contest personal jurisdiction only if you file an appearance and address on the merits. I forget, it's not the merits, I forget the word, responsive pleading.
To file a responsive pleading, but the question, becomes what is an appearance?
But what is a responsive pleading?
Responsive pleading, you're usually going to find a filed responsive pleading because, you know, at that point in time it's responsive, it's something that's written, it's something filed with the court.
But there's another case where there was a responsive, where a written appearance was filed and there was a response made verbally to where a guy asked for more time on his mortgage. That was a response to the merits of the case. Now, if this gentleman had done as you suggested and said, I object to you modifying the child support, wouldn't he be giving up his right under 301 if he said, as you suggest, well, I object to what you're doing here? He's giving up his right to contest personal jurisdiction.
No, not at all, Your Honor, because if the court has subject matter jurisdiction, then personal jurisdiction doesn't really matter.
It doesn't.
If the court doesn't have the power to act, right? Subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, the court never lost subject matter jurisdiction. Let's go back to 201. We're not talking about subject matter jurisdiction here. The court never lost the right to hear a divorce case, right? They always had the right to hear a divorce case. The question is whether or not the court had the right to hear any case of a party who doesn't live in Illinois, where none of the parties live in Illinois. And the statute says that there must be some type of consent. And the question we're here today deciding is standing up and asking for a continuance sufficient to say, okay, Illinois courts can hear the case about my out-of-state client's legal rights.
Yes, I believe it does, Your Honor, because the remedy, look, you asked to raise things in the record that somehow...
Well, let's go to statutory construction. If all that was required was for him to stand up in court, what is this language about consent on the record in court? Consent in by filing a consent or stating in the open on an open record. Well, wouldn't that language be superfluous if all that required was for him to just show up and ask for a continuance?
No, Your Honor, it's a question, is there word, there's no words in the statute to say written consent in the record. It doesn't say that.
It says the parties consent in a record or an open court.
So it's important to know the previous statute in 2001, which was amended, which required written consents.
Yeah, we're not talking about
that. Right.
Now we're in the statute. That was something that was suggested because the California court interpreted that way. But, you know, I don't think there's any requirement of a writing. It's not in the statute.
What I'm trying to tie together is that when the legislature then took that language out, it's good evidence that you don't need a written consent.
Yes.
Right.
I don't think there's any question.
And so if an attorney appears in court.
But let me ask you
this.
Yes. If an attorney comes into a court in Cook County and his client is from, where was she from?
Georgia.
If an attorney comes in to a courtroom in Illinois and says, good morning, Judge. My name is Mr. Clark, and I'm representing Jasmine. I forget her. Etheridge. The fact that she lives in Georgia, does that deprive the court of jurisdiction if an attorney comes and appears before that person?
No, because the attorney represents that person as if they're in the state of Illinois.
So didn't the, if we're going to get back to personal jurisdiction, hasn't the Supreme Court said, our Supreme Court said on multiple occasions that personal jurisdiction can be established by two things, service of process or by party voluntary submission to the court.
Correct.
So what does that mean?
Well, if
a lawyer walks up and says, Judge, here, I'm on that case, I'm representing Jasmine Etheridge, and we don't know what he said. You know, this is a case where I just don't know how we're supposed to decide issues when there's nothing here for us. There is no record. There is no bystanders report. There is no agreed statement of facts.
Right.
You know, so for all we know, I mean, we just don't know.
Well, we do have to have something to show jurisdiction. What do we have in this record to show there is jurisdiction?
We have Attorney Christopher Clark appearing on behalf of the petitioner.
Well, then,
and seeking to continue.
And also allowing
And then allowing certain remedies to happen.
Three orders.
Given that.
Substantive orders.
Substantive orders. Let's do this. Let's assume, yes, Christopher Clark represented her. He stood up. The court entered these orders. And that's the case. Now, what statute, what case do you have that says that he has waived his right to contest personal jurisdiction by standing silent? Do you have a case? You have a statute. The statute's unambiguous. It says one way to do it, and that's by filing. You have a case that says that that is sufficient to waive jurisdiction.
Well, let me interject. I'll add some facts to Justice Collins. There is nothing in this record that says the attorney stood silent. Nothing.
Correct. And the attorney took affirmative action.
We don't know. Well, we know that he allowed a number of substantive rulings to occur, modifying an order.
Without objection.
And also, well, I mean.
We do know one thing. Did he file an appearance or did he file a plea?
Well, it's a question of did he file an appearance or is not.
He appeared.
He appeared.
Did he file a plea?
He did not, file a pleading or he did not file an appearance, but he did represent to the court. He's appearing on behalf of and was given leave to file an appearance.
And isn't that what the statute says? The only way you waive your objection to personal jurisdiction is by filing. The only exclusive way.
Okay.
But it's by filing.
But he never filed that.
I know.
He allowed the proceedings to continue besides going to court, and he never filed it. And to the court's query, what is it supposed to be?
Wait a minute. Now you're saying something different. Now you're saying had he came back to court the following month and found something, what would it would have been different? He could have objected a month later.
Yeah, because I think
I'm asking you. You're saying he could have objected a month later.
Yeah.
But so what gives him the right to object a month later?
Okay.
When you say he waived that day.
Thank you for the question. Let's look at the Collins case because that was cited in the brief of the appellate. Now the Collins case is the Second District case. In that case, initially the parties, or at least one party, lived in Illinois. When this modification came up, nobody was in Illinois. The state was representing the obligee. The father had filed a motion to modify. The case was proceeding. Judge Dungeon, Second District Judge, DuPage County Judge, said, look, nobody lives here. I'm reading 205A2. There's no consent. You're out of here. And the father said, wait a second. The department waived the issue by not bringing it up after filing their first response to pleading. The appellate court addressed that. They affirmed the case, but they said, this is the distinction between this case, our case, and the Collins case, is they make a special point to say the father was apprised and was allowed to make the argument about jurisdiction. All right? So in that case, to your question, the judge on his own brought the issue up after response to pleading was filed. So I think Mr. Clark could have done this, but the important part is the father had the opportunity at the trial court level to say, I disagree with you. Mr. Jameson is deprived of that. And to the court's question, what is the remedy here? Mr. Jameson has no remedy if the court overturns Judge Yu.
Why doesn't he have
Because you can only modify support.
Why shouldn't the parties have to go back to the court and then actually swear to testimony as opposed to just saying, well, gee, he was my attorney. Well, no, he wasn't my attorney.
Right. So since you two.
Wait a minute. What about acquiescence? Can a party acquiesce and say, Judge, we're not contesting jurisdiction? We're complaining about due process and a right to be heard. So if a party acquiesces and the court moves forward, can they complain on appeal about the acquiescence to a question of jurisdiction?
No, so it's a waiver.
No, about that. Can you actually waive? Can the parties waive jurisdiction?
Well, that gets to the revestment question. It's more of a subject matter jurisdiction. But if you act as if and participate in the case, I know the question would be, well, he didn't participate. But if you act as if, then yes.
Well, we don't know if this lawyer. It seems like the lawyer participated. There's an order.
Correct.
Apparently the lawyer's there. No one has suggested he wasn't there. The court entered substantive rulings. It actually modified things. And then the court also pointed out that the court has jurisdiction of the parties.
Right.
And that's what the record
reflects. That's what the record reflects. And to read anything otherwise is to read something in the record.
Well, the question is whether or not that crucial beginning, December of 2015. Whether or not that is consent in open court. Did the parties consent in open court?
Correct.
Does a party consent in open court if she or he or they send an attorney there and the attorney appears in the courtroom, the judge enters substantive orders that are not in any way denied in this record? Does that amount to consent?
I believe it does, and in this case it especially does just because of the history of the case, that there were actions in this case from the very beginning where nobody lived in this state. 2009, there was a modification in 2011 and 2012. And so, you know, the consent was always there. So it was not just that Mr. Clark came into court. But
I think you're really expanding things by that remark. The Collins case said you can enforce your orders, you cannot modify them. And this statute says that the timing of the filing for a request for modification, isn't that what your client was doing, asking for a modification? And I'm not sure that it's acceptable to argue that, they consented earlier.
And I don't think you have to even go there to affirm the trial court. I think the important fact is that there was an attorney that on the record appeared on Ms. Etheridge's behalf, that there was action taken without objection. There was then the receipt of a substantial reduction in support, so there's notice and no action. And the question the court really has to consider, which is formed in the case law under estoppel, but what is the remedy, as the court pointed out? And the reason there is no remedy for Mr. Jameson.
Well, that's the argument for a different day. We're dealing today with the question of jurisdiction. You raised some other defenses, and that can be answered another day. I think the question we have to answer today is whether or not there was jurisdiction. And that's really what we're talking about, I think. And, you know, I'm trying to get to the point. We have an issue of personal jurisdiction. If you don't have any case to support your position that if a judge makes a substantive order in the presence of an attorney, that the attorney waives jurisdiction. You don't have any cases to say that, right?
I don't have a case saying there's a waiver, but there's...
It's an exception, but it is an exception.
But at some point, there has to be a time limit within... So in essence, I would argue that they waived... If they're allowed to contest jurisdiction down the road, they never did it in this case.
Until they filed a 1401 petition.
Right, but then the question then becomes, is it void or voidable? And so to that question, perhaps it would have been better settled if Ms. Etheridge came to court within 2 years, but to wait for 6 years and say it's a void order, not a voidable order, is substantially
That's
different.
That's not what the case law says. If something's void, there's not a two-year time.
Correct, but if an attorney comes into court and the allegation is he's not my attorney, or there's no personal jurisdiction, they never raise that issue if the attorney appeared. Then there is that time.
But the legislature knows what it's doing in these types of cases because, for example, in mortgage foreclosure cases, they have a rule that if an attorney comes to court and appears or files an appearance, the time limit to file a motion to quash is 60 days. It doesn't deal, you know, they can put limits to file a motion to quash, but the legislature anticipates people coming to court and orders being entered because they say, clearly and unambiguously, the only way. And, you know, the Supreme Court has given us guidance on that. You know, we can't make an exception to that rule because the Supreme Court says the only way we can make additions and exceptions is if a statute is ambiguous. Here, the statute as it existed in 2014, 2012,2015 when this arose, because the 2014 statute was in effect, it says the only way is by filing an appearance or a response to pleading. That was not done. Now you're saying that although this was not done, some other things took place which waived jurisdiction. Do you have a case?
Well, I have a statute, I have 205A2, which is consent. And I would argue
that's what I'm saying. This consent, the consent in 205A2 is consent for general jurisdiction. It's not for personal jurisdiction or subject matter jurisdiction because we're talking about divorce cases. Of course, divorce courts can hear divorce cases. That's not subject matter jurisdiction. We look at the case you just cited, Konecki. They said the court, in order to exercise jurisdiction, has to get these consents. So they're not talking about subject matter. They're talking about general jurisdiction. right?
Correct.
So how does this client give up general jurisdiction when a gentleman steps up and says, I want a continuance?
Because when an attorney comes to court speaking for that client and appears and never appears again, they definitely lose their right to contest it.
Where's that been?
Well, think about the ramifications if it's not, Your Honor. I mean, think, also what he has to do is attorney has...
Wasn't his request for a continuance to respond to the petition filed by by Timothy Jamieson?
Correct.
He didn't ask for just a continuance for nothing. The summary judgment hearing indicates that the request was for a continuance. It's in your briefs. I think both of you have said that. I don't know. That the request was for a continuance to respond to the pending motion to modify. At the same time, the court entered substantive rulings with that attorney standing there, and the court found in his order that this cause set for hearing by an order, by order. This, Judge Kaplan, rest his soul. This is, I believe this is his writing. Okay. I'm going to try to read it again. By order of court, on 10-23-15, respondent appearing through counsel and present, attorney Christopher Clark, appearing on behalf of petitioner and seeking a continuance, the court so apprised orders, and then it orders without prejudice to retroactively or amount, respondent shall pay $1,000 per month child support through whatever the section. Christopher Clark leave to file by an appearance on behalf of petitioner. Petitioner something, in an additional 28 days to answer the, I think it says the pleading or petition to revise, review child support and petitioners to determine the amount. And then I can't read what four says, something, request this within 45 days.
Discovery.
Yes, you're right. Thank you. And then respondent, well, that I can't read. Something about 503. Temporary, oh, yes, the trust funds, the $1,000 were temporarily suspended. And maybe someone else can read. And then it was set for another hearing, March 16, 2016. So we know the court entered numerous orders that day with an attorney. And, you know, this talk about did he appear, didn't he appear, did he file an appearance, blah, 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 whatever. We have two conflicting statutes. Justice House refers to 301. It has language specific. But then 205 also has language. And we're supposed to determine on this record that has no report of proceedings, that has no bystanders report, that has no agreed statement of facts, which are required under the rule, we're supposed to determine from this order and the record, which is only common law, strictly orders of the court, we're supposed to determine whether or not this case equals consent in open court.
Well, didn't the trial court, when it entered summary judgment, make a finding that merely appearing and asking for consent and standing there was sufficient to waive or consent? So that's what all we have. The fact is that the entire ruling, that's what we're judging of the court. The court says by the attorney coming in and standing up and asking for a continuance, that's consent. We're not talking about what else he may have said, because I was not argued at the summary judgment hearing. We've not talked about what else he may have said about consenting, because that's not even argued at the motion for summary judgment. The court said that by standing up and asking for a continuance, that's waiver. And that's what we would sign. That's a simple question. We don't need a transcript for that, do we?
Well, see, I would have to disagree with Justice House, because I think we have to decide about the 2015. I think we have to decide whether what happened that day when the court entered these orders, and we have this record that he's entered these orders, I think that's a question before us, too. because we have an order.
It was decided.
And so I'm just saying that there's also this question of whether this alone, this order by Judge Kaplan, does that follow the statute? Was this, you know, consent in open court? And also, I think as Justice House has, and I think Justice House has also accurately pointed out that this other statute says if you just come in, you don't ask for, you don't file a pleading, you're not asking for relief, that under 301, you can contest jurisdiction later. So, I mean, there's a culpable.
So even if Judge Yu cited an outdated case and his conclusion was just merely coming into court and asking for a continuance equates to consent, that's not what happened here, right? I mean, because there are three orders on part. It's not just an order for a continuance. So is that action, is that not consent, right, from the December 2015 hearing?
I believe it is, and I think Judge Yu in finding 12 noted that, at least indirectly, when he did not object to the jurisdiction. I know it doesn't address the court's concern, but the court also entered temporary child support orders and suspended the 503G, so there's action taken. So that, in addition, I think, adds.
So it's not just merely standing up and asking for a continuance.
Right. You're seeing things happen in front of you, and you stand silent. And he did receive relief from Ms. Etheridge at that time because the order says he sought a continuance, which the court granted.
But that's not enough under 301.
It's not enough. I agree. Yeah.
When we go back to the purpose of 205, it's a Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. Is that the whole purpose of this sort of statute? Is because we don't want courts in different states to be entering all sorts of different orders that could potentially be in conflict with each other, right?
Correct. That was the whole purpose. And in the 90s, it was tied to funding from the federal government. The states needed to get together. All 50 states had to pass it. And you had to have one venue or one place that was issuing child support orders so there wasn't confusion.
And that's the gold standard they were trying to get to, yet also give the parties an out if they wanted to, say, file in Georgia or some other state.
Correct.
So in this case, there were no filings in any other state except Illinois, right?
That's correct.
Do you see any significance to that?
I do, and it was one of my initial arguments, the fact that they've always acted as if this court had jurisdiction. From the very beginning, nobody lived here, so this was the one court that was deciding child support. So I think it would be an entirely different case if for some reason they started a case here with nobody living here. That would be a different case than this one. But if we look at the committee comments as well, they talk about that jurisdiction may be lost if all relevant persons have permanently left the state, but they never were here to begin with. So the purpose of the statute, UIFSA, federal government urging the states to unify their procedures, to have one state issue an order, is fulfilled by their action from 2009 forward.
So this is consistent with the legislative intent, the way the August 2024 order was entered.
I believe that's correct, yes.
Justice McBride?
No, nothing further. Anyway,
thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
And Ms. Fortress, you have a minute to respond if you so choose.
I don't think I even have that. That's very nice of you. Just very quickly, because counsel argued for the first time today that the parties consent to their, well, really going back to the very first case, the initial child support order operated as a continuing consent as a result just doesn't make sense under the statute.
First of all, it's my understanding that Timothy was temporarily residing with his parents, and that's why she served him here the first time, although she never resided here. So the first case, the child support order was entered. He filed the first modification in 2012, and she consented to participate like we discussed before. But again, the purpose of the statute, which you can see from the committee comments, is really the convenience of the parties. Yeah, you've all gone elsewhere. Yes, you're all elsewhere. But, you know, if it's most convenient for you, if you're most comfortable in this forum and you agree, sure, we'll modify the previously entered order. So I don't think this concept of an ongoing, years-long consent is consistent with the statute. The only other thing I'll say quickly is that this subsection 201, which talks about an individual submitting to the jurisdiction of the state, by its very language, is relevant only in a proceeding to establish or enforce a support order. It doesn't seem to contemplate modification to me. So that's the only.
Should we send this matter back because there's a question of fact regarding just what Ms. Etheridge agreed to when an attorney stepped up for her? Should we send this back to see if she actually consented, where she would have to testify under oath and Mr. Jameson would have to testify as well? Is your position that there's no question of fact, or is there a question of fact whether or not her conduct in this case with this lawyer coming up, she said he didn't represent her, but then she said she did, but then her mother told her that she got him, mother lived in Georgia when she lived in Georgia. Should we send it back for the court to determine whether or not there was consent under the meaning of this statute?
I would say on these facts, you should find that there was never that she never submitted herself to the personal jurisdiction of the court. If you are inclined to consider whether a lawyer attending court on one occasion and saying that he's doing so for a party could constitute consent under 205A2, then given the summary judgment context, yes, I would say that would require a remand because we have no idea what the circumstances surrounding all of that are.
Well, do we have any knowledge of the circumstances of her mother getting this lawyer to appear and then the lawyer appeared and then she said he wasn't representing her, but then he was representing her and then he was there on her behalf and then he wasn't there on her behalf? I mean,
respectfully, again, Justice McBride, she never said that he represented her.
No, the word wasn't represented. Yeah, so you can have that, but not the rest.
My question is this. Even if she did hire and even if she did ask him to go to court, yeah, under the law, was there a waiver of personal jurisdiction?
No.
Under
even
the
if he filed an appearance that date, she wouldn't have submitted herself to the personal jurisdiction of the court because she would still not have waived her right to object to the jurisdiction of the court because unless he filed an appearance and a response of pleading that date, for example. But he did. She did. Okay. Thank you. It's going to be an interesting lunch, I think.